Support for this public radio podcast comes from Thrivent Financial, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. ThriveInFinancial.com/retirement.
Hi, I'm Tessa McLund. So, how's your bank doing? Do you know? Do you even want to know?
There are some bumps in the road, but these banks have earning power and they have capital that's going to let them get by this.
Phew. Feel better now? Yeah, for a little while, till we remember Fanny and Freddie. Should we get all verklempt or...
drink a glass of Chardonnay, chew some brie, and chill out a little bit. Everything will be fine.
Okay. But once we get past the banks and the housing mess, what's that you say about a missing 401k contribution?
I talked to the chief financial officer, and he says, well, they had other bills to pay.
Now you've got our attention. Indy Mac, Freddie Mac, how about some Cheesy Mac? It's all coming up on Marketplace Money, Mac, from American Public Media, Mac. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Ever feel like you're watching It's a Wonderful Life and it's not even December? The Bedford Falls Building and Loan got some company last week following a classic run on IndyMac Bank. Hear any bells ringing? I'm Tess Vigland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
So, where do we start? Let's go with the banks, and then we'll get to Fannie and Freddie. It's been just over a week since the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation shut down and then took over IndyMac. We went to the bank's Pasadena headquarters this week as depositors waited in line to withdraw their funds and wondered how things got this bad.
All right, folks, so we're going to do
I thought that a large bank, you would hear rumblings of things going on, but it was just boom, all of a sudden.
That's my retirement. That's my hard-earned money.
You expect some things like this in Central and South America where, like, you know, banks get taken over, they go under. But in the States, you're always like, banks don't go under in the United States.
Oh, yes, they do. Now, IndyMac was, of course, a member of the FDIC. So for the most part, deposits were perfectly safe. But we've invited banking analyst Bert Ely to answer some questions about the fallout. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here today.
So we went out to IndyMac on Monday morning as people were getting back to the bank trying to figure out if their deposits were safe or not. And the first person we're going to hear from is a gentleman, Chin Liao, and he has a question about his CD that is at IndyMac.
Well, actually, the problem is it's over 100,000. But then I called last week FDIC and because I have two beneficiaries, and they told me, oh, don't worry about it. It's insured up to 200,000.
All right, Bert, is that correct? Is 200,000 for a CD?
It could well be, but because the $100,000 deposit insurance limits applies to all the accounts in a customer's name, so that if he has, let's say, a passbook savings account there and a checking account, those balances would be taken into account along with the balance on the CD to determine what his overall deposit balance is, and then the question of beneficiaries would be taken into consideration.
All right, and finally, we hear from Gianni Galati, and we found him as he was exiting IndyMac Bank this past Monday, and he wasn't quite sure where to go after he left the bank.
So now it's like you're running around going, what do I do with all this money? Do I just go and pay off my house and pay everything off, or do I keep a large reserve?
All right, so Bert, this is a question that we've gotten from a lot of listeners this week, which is, what am I supposed to do with my money? I mean, say you're lucky enough to have, what, $600,000 in the bank. Should you take that to six different banks in order to have the $100,000 protection in each one of them?
Well, in the first instance, you should put the money in a bank. there's nothing gained by just either hanging on to the cash. If a depositor is particularly risk adverse, then they ought to spread their money over several different banks, keeping less than $100,000 in a particular bank, so that if you have money in three different banks, you have three different $100,000 limits working for you.
How much investigating should consumers have to do before they decide where to put their money?
Well, the reason we have a limit on the amount of deposit insurance is we want, quote, depositor discipline. Mm-hmm. And that is, we want depositors to look at banks, and if they see a bank's in trouble, not to put their money into it and to run. But your question raises an excellent point, and that is, how well can people actually assess the condition of their bank? And quite frankly, very few people can do it. I feel reasonably well qualified to do it because I've been doing it for almost 35 years. But even then, I don't always catch all failures, and the banking regulators certainly don't. Now, there are various rating services that try to evaluate the condition of a bank. You can find these on the web. Another is to talk to people, to talk to knowledgeable people in the community, particularly to bankers.
You mentioned you've been watching the banking system for 35 years, and let me ask you to put on kind of your consumer hat. And how concerned are you about the banking system, given what's happening right now?
I am not.
Okay.
We've had relatively few banking failures in recent years, and most of those have been smaller banks where often there's been an element of insider fraud. But the system as a whole is strong. It's well capitalized. There are some bumps in the road, but these banks have earning power and they have capital that's going to let them get by this. And I, quite frankly, am very concerned about the anxieties that have developed. I think they're excessive. I think they've been fed in great part by the IndyMac situation. And I certainly hope we don't have another situation like that anytime soon.
Bert Ely is a banking consultant in Alexandria, Virginia. Bert, thanks so much for coming on and helping us answer some of these questions that folks are really worried about these days.
Glad to be here.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
Next in line for a financial mugshot, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. As you may have heard, an implicit federal government guarantee backing up the two companies became an explicit one this week. Will it be enough? Professor Anthony Sanders of Arizona State University is with us. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much.
So we've been hearing for several months now, kind of concerns about Fannie and Freddie. Were they going to be okay? They were taking on a whole lot more mortgages because the rest of the banking industry was kind of falling apart. What happened within the last week and a half to suddenly send these stocks tumbling and get the federal government so concerned?
Well, here's the problem that's facing all financial institutions in the United States, as well as corporations. There simply is a lack of capital coming in from overseas and even domestically for the banking industry.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, banks need money to turn around and lend. And if their money isn't there, funds dry up, and that can impact home buyers. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that.
Given all the concern about Fannie and Freddie, what potential effect could this have on people whose mortgages are currently sitting with Fannie and Freddie or were backed by Fannie and Freddie, or people who are trying to get into the mortgage market?
Okay. With regard to people that have a mortgage that currently resides with Fannie and Freddie,
mm-hmm.
there's no impact. Fannie and Freddie either hold the mortgage in portfolio, and they will continue to accept payments on the mortgage. They're not going to sit there and suddenly jack up your rates for no reason at all.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a fixed-rate mortgage, if you have an adjustable-rate mortgage, it's just going to fulfill the terms of the contract. Now, for people that are going to be going into the mortgage market, What impact will this have? And the answer is, number one, all that's happened right now is that the government is just stepping in and saying, okay, we will provide liquidity where needed, period. So we're not going to see rates spiking. If you're waiting to buy a house right now and you're worried that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac conforming loan rates are going to jump 1% over the next 60 days, well, they could. But it's not due to Fannie and Freddie.
What would happen if the government did not step in?
Right now, there still is no problem. Freddie and Fannie, just like any financial institution.
Unless you're a shareholder, right?
Now, I would not want to be a shareholder today of Freddie and Fannie, because they came out and said, it's possible that Freddie and Fannie's stock may actually go to zero.
Right.
Employees are going to, not be very happy if they happen to have stock options, and shareholders in general are going to be hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for the average consumer out there, the average person in the mortgage market, Freddie and Fannie are still your friend.
Well, I don't think this thing is ending anytime soon, so I'm sure we'll talk to you again at some point.
I will. Just advocate to potential homebuyers to drink a glass of Chardonnay, chew some brie, and chill out a little bit. Everything will be fine with Freddie and Fannie.
Okay, we have your word on that?
Absolutely.
Anthony Sanders teaches finance at Arizona State University. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, we have just been discussing the big news of the week, the FDIC taking over IndyMac, the federal government engineering this bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. We talked with Burt Ely earlier, and there could be more bank failures on the way. But let's you and I discuss what is going on with Fannie and Freddie, because this thing is just huge.
It is huge. But have you looked at how the stock prices reacted to this Paulson-Bernanke rescue plan?
That's Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke. Investors didn't like it at all.
Not at all. They decided, hey, you know what? I don't think this plan is going to save these two mortgage giants. Here's the straight story, Tess. The two companies, they're on the road to being bailed out, nationalized, and getting a lot smaller.
Let's talk about your idea of nationalization. Why would that be the solution here?
There's a deep flaw in the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, which is the taxpayer is absorbing the risk, but the profits are private. And when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were smaller, it was okay, but they're giant institutions. When you have that kind of a situation, how can any private company compete against Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac now that the federal government stands behind them?
All right, let's assume then that Fannie and Freddie are eventually nationalized. What happens to debt holders, stockholders, and the taxpayer if that comes to pass?
Shareholders, they may not be wiped out, but it'll be kind of the Bear Stearns scenario. Okay, they're worth $10 a share, or they're worth $5 a share. That's the risk. It's the nature of the beast. This is what the market's all about. The debt holders, on the other hand, will be whole. That's why the discount window at the Fed has been opened. So as far as the debt holders go, they will remain whole. As it shrinks, obviously less debt will be issued. It'll become a less important part of the overall capital markets. But I think Paulson's been very straightforward. Stockholders, don't care about them. Debt holders, we want them to remain sound.
Care to give me odds on whether this will actually happen?
I think that's inevitable.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to happen quickly, for the simple reason is no one's going to be able to move that fast. But my feeling is nationalization, now that the guarantee is explicit, you can't have this kind of quasi-public-private firm competing in the capital markets against private firms. Our system doesn't work that way.
The Straight Story from our own Chris Farrell. And Chris, as we already mentioned, we'll be back a little later in the show to answer some questions about what's going on in the banking industry. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Wait till you hear how the company paid for them. It's called a 401k float. And we go Borden in Baltimore with a hammer and a nail. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Veglund. Want to give your employer an interest-free loan? How about your 401k plan provider? Didn't think so. But that's what some Americans are doing, whether they know it or not. It's all thanks to the float. the amount of time it takes for 401k contributions to move out of your paycheck and into your retirement account. Now, a little float may be okay, but what are your rights if it's a lot? Rico Galliano dipped his toe in the deep end to find out.
So I'm sitting by my friend's pool watching their two-year-old daughter floating with her new inflatable water wings. And as she splashes, she's endangering a few $100 worth of my recording equipment, by the way. But aside from that, it's a pretty good way to cool off here in summertime Los Angeles. When your 401k money floats, though, it can be really uncool. I called a listener named Mark from Baltimore to hear his story. So what happened?
When I first started with the employer, they offered a 401k plan and had a company match of 5%. As time went on, the match dropped off, no longer offered. And pretty soon, we'd see 401k contribution taken out of her paycheck, but not appear on the 401k statement.
The money would be deducted from your paycheck, and it wouldn't appear in your 401k until later.
Correct. At times, it was months, and at times, it was many months.
Do you know why this was happening?
Times have been tight. There are times we didn't have money for paper towels.
No money for paper towels. Oh, man.
I talked to the chief financial officer, and he says, well, they had other bills to pay.
So they were holding on to your 401k contributions to pay the bills, basically.
Operating expenses, right.
Not exactly happy poolside listening, is it? Mark's contributions did eventually end up in his account, but the delay was still illegal. And it's not an isolated case. Last year, the Department of Labor says it, quote, corrected over 1,100 violations of federal rules governing 401k floats. The rules are part of a law called ERISA, which stands for
the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, which many practitioners will say actually stands for every rule is somewhat ambiguous.
That's John Hotz, deputy director of the nonprofit Pension Rights Center. I asked him to try and explain some of those ambiguous rules. Like, for instance, how fast must employers get your 401k cash into your account?
As soon as it's administratively feasible. In today's day, this is really just an automated function. It can happen within 24 to 48 hours in most situations.
Problems usually crop up with small businesses, which don't have automated 401ks and often do have an accounting staff of just one person. By law, even they have to deposit an employee contribution within 15 days after the month it's deducted from a paycheck. But Hote says some small businesses simply don't know that. In fact, a few don't seem to know much of anything about 401ks.
The call came in from an employee of a small concern that was family-owned and operated, and it ended up that the plan administrator had really no idea what responsibilities were involved in administering a 401k plan. So I ended up buying a small desktop reference book for this person and put some post-it notes on certain pages.
But what if the problem isn't your employer? Tim Wood is with Deschutes Investment Advisors in Portland, Oregon.
There's two sides of the float. One is the employer side and the other, I guess I would call, the investment side.
That's when the 401k provider sits on your money a while, even after they get it from your employer.
Why this is a problem is that every day that money's floating, the investment provider is actually earning income on it because it's being invested in short-term accounts. And that money is not being credited to the participants. So in effect, it really is a fee.
A short provider float may be unavoidable, but if it becomes too long, it's your employer's legal responsibility to get on the provider's case about it. So if you've told your boss about a long float and nothing's been done, it might be time to call in the Department of Labor. Of course, whistleblowers in small companies risk a lot. That's why our listener, Mark, didn't blow a whistle.
I didn't like it, but what I'm going to do, call the federal authorities, jeopardize the company, jeopardize my job.
Actually, maybe. The Pension Rights Center's John Hote says it can work out for the best. But employees who take the plunge should be ready to sink or swim. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace Money.
We've got links to ERISA information and how to contact the Department of Labor on our website. It's marketplace.org. Had enough of Fannie and Freddie and the banks yet? Well, we're trying to parse it out so it's not all in one undigestible chunk. You could say we're amortizing the information. What is this amortization? Well, it's the topic of today's Marketplace Money Summer School session. At the blackboard once again, Jonathan Clements.
When people refer to amortization or amortizing loans, what they mean is that with every monthly loan payment, Part of your money is going toward paying interest, and part is going toward paying down the amount you originally borrowed. The classic example of this is a mortgage. Suppose you take out a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage at 6%. Just 17% of your first monthly payment will go toward principal, and the other 83% will go toward interest. But as you whittle down the loan's principal balance, the mix gradually shifts so that you owe less and less interest each month. Indeed, by the time you get to year 30 and you make that final monthly payment, more than 99% of your payment will go toward reducing the loan's principal balance. This is one of the reasons Americans often say that their home is the best investment they ever made. If you have an amortizing mortgage, you're effectively saving money each month as you pay down the loan's principal balance. Trouble is, not every mortgage is amortizing. During the heady days of the real estate boom, some people took out interest-only mortgages, which meant they weren't paying down any of the loan's principal balance for maybe the first 5 years of the mortgage. Some even took out mortgages where they had the option to make monthly payments that were less than the interest due each month, which meant that the loan balance was increasing and they could face far, far higher monthly payments down the road. In effect, if you're going to build up home equity with a negatively amortizing loan, you have to rely on home prices rising. The trouble is, of course, we haven't seen a whole lot of that in recent years.
Jonathan Clements is the Director of Financial Guidance for MyFi, an advisory service from Citigroup. Next week, naked short selling. Oh, my.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at gather.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
All right, it's time for Getting Personal when we take a look at your questions and hopefully provide you with some answers. And with me once again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, we had a lot of questions come in this week about what is going on with the banks in this country.
A lot of questions.
Not a pretty picture.
No, absolutely.
So let's take a look at some of them. We answered a few questions earlier on with Bert Ely, but these have a little bit of a different bent to them. So let's start with Patricia in Cincinnati. She wrote in and wondered what happens to her IRA investments when a bank fails or has other difficulties. She's not necessarily in the bank. She's in the mutual fund. How is that affected by a bank's collapse then?
Well, it's not really affected much at all. She still has her IRA account. It's safe. She has the ownership. If the IRA money is in a savings account or money market deposit account, she has the FDIC insurance up to $250,000.
And then above that, no guarantee?
No guarantee. But that's a lot of money.
And it, in fact, if you are holding this much cash, then we wouldn't call you diversified, would we?
No, we would not at all.
Okay. Jeff wrote in from Glendale here in California. He has a CD with Countrywide and a CD with Bank of America. He's wondering, is he still FDIC insured even though the two banks have merged? And let me clarify then, that means that his total invested is over $100,000.
That's a good question. So let's say he had a $60,000 CD at Countrywide and a $60,000 CD at Bank of America. Now he has $120,000, so he's $20,000 at risk. However, these situations, the FDIC has a grace period. And so what the grace period is, with a checking account, savings account, you get essentially 6 months to adjust your money. And with the CDs, you're protected until they mature.
Okay. If you've got some questions, do let us help. Visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Robert wrote in from The Villages, Florida, and this isn't necessarily about bank accounts, but I think this whole situation has got people worried about all of their money, no matter where it is. And he's a little concerned about the safety of his IRA, even though it's being held by a private investment company, you know, the likes of Fidelity and TIAA CREF. Should he be thinking of spreading that money around over, you know, half a dozen firms to limit the risk if one of those fails? Again, we're not talking about banks here. We're talking about investment houses.
That's right. I mean, again, just to reiterate, the primary protection is that your money is in the market. That's no protection about the value of your money. So it's always a balancing act. You do want to have some diversification. You don't want to have so much diversification that it becomes difficult to manage your money. Most of us end up being fairly well diversified on our own if everything is with one institution, but it pays to shop around. It pays to be somewhat diversified, but I don't think it pays to slice and dice everything up too small, and then you're running around trying to keep on top of 8, 10, 12 institutions.
All right. Veronica wrote in from Loudonville, New York, and she says she has some Freddie notes in her IRA, and they're supposed to be providing her a nice little income. Are they now worthless?
No, they are not worthless. The notes of the debt are still valuable.
So these are bonds, basically.
These are bonds, right? And they have all different maturities. And what has the federal government said? In essence, we're guaranteeing this debt. Over a period of time, I think it's perfectly valid for people to ask questions, but there is no reason for anyone out there to panic. The federal government has put its full faith and credit behind it. Right or wrong, that's what they've done.
Okay. Chris, I'm just wondering if you might share with folks kind of what your strategy is right now. I mean, are you worried about the banking system at all? Have you pulled your money out anywhere? Have you decided to spread it around more than you would normally?
I'm not worried about the banking system overall. Now I'm just talking about as an individual. Since 1933, since the FDIC was formed, no one's lost a penny in an insured deposit. I see no reason for that to change. Secondly, I don't think it comes as any surprise to you, Tess, that I have a well-diversified portfolio, which is down.
I hope so.
It is way down, but it is a well-diversified portfolio. What is true is that I have been pursuing no real changes in my retirement portfolio, my long-term money. What I have been doing is building up more savings. So in a sense, I have adopted a strategy that intellectually I've always liked, which is to stay very risky in terms of the retirement, the long-term money, but in my personal life, my emergency savings, I've gone more conservative. I think people have to really move toward a world where they're paying more out of cash and less with their credit card, which is a fancy way of saying build up your savings.
All right, Chris, let's get in one more email here. And Toshar wrote in from Raleigh, North Carolina, and wanted to know, can the common man buy shares in Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae because they're quite the discount right now? And is that a good idea?
Yes, it is possible. Very simple to do. They have a lot of shares outstanding. If it were me, as I remarked earlier on, you know, I think these firms are going to be nationalized.
Mm-hmm.
And U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson has made it very clear, whether they're nationalized or however the bailout evolves over time, he's not interested in protecting the shareholders. So I think it's a lot more fun to go to Las Vegas. But be fully warned, you're making a bet that the current bailout is going to be enough.
Oh, right. So I think we hear the hint from Chris Farrell's voice there that he doesn't think it's going to be enough. So there you go, Toshar. Thanks for writing in. If you've got a question, do give us a call. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we are answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link there. And do stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This week, Hollywood announced Emmy nominees. Mad Men and Damages became the first basic cable shows to get the Best Series nod. But HBO's gritty cop serial, The Wire, robbed, yo, again. No Best Drama noms for one of the best dramas in TV history. Feel me? The show takes place in Baltimore, Maryland. And in this scene, murder police Lester Freeman uncovers a major clue in a series of homicides.
This nail here comes from a nail gun. And it comes from the house with a dead man inside. Every other house has screws that HCD uses. We find these in the plywood anywhere in the city, and there's a body inside.
Freeman was referring to vast numbers of abandoned and boarded up houses dotting the cityscape. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet a man who does some real-life boarding up, minus the bodies.
Hello, my name is Sean Chapman. My job is boarding up vacant houses. We use a screw gun, and sometimes we have to put the boards through the brick. We use a hammer. I call a molly. First of all, we just go up to the house and look on our work order what needs to be done. Me and my partner, we go around back. We take a picture of it. We go up to the door window, take measurements of the door and window, and we give it to the cutter. And he look at it, he cuts it, he measure it, and he gives it to me, and I put it on the door. Take another picture, let them know we done it, and we leave and go to the next job. Right now, I make like $26,000 a year. It's dangerous because, you know, majority of the time when we board these houses, you know, we really in drug-related areas. My first day, I was going inside of a house to do a window, and a lady was in there getting high, and I didn't see her. And as I came downstairs, another guy came in, so I was so nervous I really couldn't board the house up. But we have that problem a lot. Some people don't say anything when they're in the houses, you know, because they're more afraid than you are. And we only have a hammer. We don't know what they have, a knife or gun, so we really at risk what we do. A few years back, we was riding up. A young boy had got killed, and he was laying across the street against the wall. Now, I think that was the first time I ever seen somebody get killed, and it kind of got me, you know, heart-wise, and it was just very shocking. The job is, you know, it's a public relations job. This is a fine young woman here. She says she's 90, but I'm thinking she looked 50. You have to respect the neighbors because you're going to end up seeing them again. They come out and ask you questions, you know, and sometimes we joke with them. Every time I come around, she's always out here. And every time I ask for breakfast, she always offer, but sometimes she say, well, you go ahead and go to work and I'll have it for you. And I was like, okay. Yeah, so next time I think I'll probably come over for lunch, you know, something like that next week or something.
You should be taking me out for lunch.
See, this is what I go through. I watched The Wire. I mean, it was with the vacants, you know, to see the guys and the cops finding bodies and houses we used to board up. And you never imagined that you will see your job on TV, you know. And I joke with my wife. I say, well, where they at? Where they located? I'm great. Man, family, go over there and board it back up. Sometimes I bring it home. Sometimes I just pray about it and just leave it at that. Because at times, you know, people have to do what they have to do to live. Some of them live in these vacant houses. Some of them have families that we have to put out these houses. It's to a point that almost brought tears to my eyes because they, you know, these little kids that have to suffer because the mother or father made a poor decision of putting this child in a situation.
We've got photos of Sean Chapman on our website. It's marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was produced by Lawrence Lanahan. Coming up, we look at what you can do for the people who survive you in death.
It helps them immediately, and if that's your spouse, which in most cases it is, quite frankly, your spouse is going to need cash at the time that you die and may not comfortably be able to wait.
We'll go through the basics of life insurance. And believe it or not, some companies are adding to their employee bennies. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Today we continue our conversations about the end. It's called estate planning. As part of this series, we're talking to people who deal with death on a regular basis. Today, someone who provides spiritual counseling to families.
My name is Gary Oren. I'm the rabbi at Temple Aliyah in Woodland Hills, California. Part of my training in seminary was clinical pastoral education at UCLA Santa Monica, where I served 400 clinical hours working in geriatrics, oncology, and ER, being the chaplain to the entire population base of the hospital. Part of the work that I did was to answer calls when there was an emergency. So you would be called in to assist the family at the time of making a end-of-life decision. What I saw in the hospital, when there was somebody that was at end of life and they had not made decisions about what care they should receive, how they should receive it, what to do with their financial estate. There was a lot of complication over who was going to make that decision once the person was incapacitated. And then there was other decisions that were about, and what do we do next? I've been in part of cases where there hasn't been much forethought, and you watch as one family member will step up to make the decisions. And when that person steps up, what I saw more often than not, they were sort of villainized in some way, because it's an intense emotional time, and they're making a decision either who gets what or what treatment to give, how to give that treatment, and sometimes to end treatment. I think that it's always smart to have the financial house not only in order, but to have it known. So I'm 36 years old. My wife is 30. My children are 4 and 2, and my wife, we're expecting our third. So it's funny, when I was working in the hospital, I became very adamant about having at least advance directives. I'm one of few young people that I know that I have in place a living will. In addition, I wrote for my family an ethical will and a value-based life plan. I felt it's my responsibility.
That's Rabbi Gary Oren from Temple Aliyah in Woodland Hills, California. And now we're joined once again by John Ventura. He's the author of Kiplinger's Estate Planning. Glad to have you back, John.
Thanks for having me back, Tess.
All right. So today we're going to talk about life insurance and who needs it and who doesn't. So let me ask you that very basic question. Who needs life insurance? At what age, if you're single, do you need it? If you're married without children, do you need it?
Let's take the young single person, because that's the one that probably has the hardest time making this decision. You may want to have people have some money when you die, even though you don't have a lot of assets, and that's what life insurance does. And it could be something like, you know, I have a mother that's not going to be able to take care of herself if I'm not around, so I want to have life insurance that's going to take care of her for her needs if I end up dying young. So if you have some concerns like that, then you may want to have a life insurance policy. Now, the way that insurance companies encourage young people to have insurance at a young age is they combine it with some kind of investment. In other words, what they're saying to you is if you buy a certain kind of policy, that part of your premium is building up a cash reserve that you can borrow against if you need the money. That cash reserve also, at some later date, pays premiums so that your premiums don't go up.
All right. And married without children?
You always want to take care of your spouse, and you just never know about the uncertainties of life and change. And so even a young person, if you're married without children, I think it's a very thoughtful and loving thing to do is to have insurance to take care of your spouse if something should happen to you.
Okay. And fairly obvious that if you do have children, a family, that you need some life insurance to leave them if something happens to you.
Yes, you should. We've talked in the past about estate planning. An insurance policy is one of those types of things where you designate a beneficiary, mm-hmm. and your heirs get that money right away, and it doesn't go through probate. So having insurance in addition to all of your other investments is a good thing to think about for your heirs and the money that they may need immediately if something should happen to you.
Because with a will, they may have to wait a while.
They may have to wait a while if there's a will to get any of your assets.
And take us through the three main kinds of life insurance, term versus whole versus universal.
Term life insurance is the cheapest kind that you can buy, and it's for a specific period of time. Basically, when you reach the end of that time, if you take out a 10-year term policy, then all the money that you've invested in it would have gone away. You wouldn't have any kind of cash reserve. And that's all it does. And it gives just a specific amount. It doesn't create any kind of money in a fund that you can borrow against or anything like that. That's the cheapest you can get. Whole and universal are almost alike. What they do is they have that investment component in them that allows you to build some kind of fund of money that you can borrow against. That money can also be used to reduce premiums later on,
you can get these policies to last for long periods of time. Now, the thing is that because it has the investment component, usually a whole life or universal policy is going to cost more than a term life policy.
All right. And again, as you said, in terms of how life insurance works, you know, within the estate planning process, within wills and trusts, it is very much separate. But the benefit there is that sum of money will come to you fairly quickly.
Yes. And it does come almost immediately for the beneficiaries. It helps them immediately. And if that's your spouse, which in most cases it is, quite frankly, your spouse is going to need cash at the time that you die and may not comfortably be able to wait for your will to be probated and your assets given to you, because the probate process first requires that all debts be paid before any kind of property is given to the heirs. And that could take months and months and months.
John Ventura is the author of Kiplinger's Estate Planning, and over the last several weeks, we've been talking to him about wills and durable power of attorney and living wills. And John, thanks so much for educating the audience.
Thanks, Tess.
And next week, we'll get to your estate planning questions. If you've missed any of our series, visit marketplace.org and click on the link that says, Not Quite 6 Feet Under.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
Back again with Getting Personal, and once again I'm joined by Chris Farrell, our personal finance expert. And Chris, let's go right to the phones. Hank is with us from Athens, Georgia. Hello, Hank.
Hey, Tess and Chris.
So what do you do there in Athens?
Well, I'm pursuing dual degrees in public administration and social work, and I'm also engaged to the smartest, most beautiful, and kind woman in the world.
Oh, good for you.
And Tess, you'd be happy to know that because I saved, I was able to get a better ring.
Oh, well, I think that the proposal itself is what matters. The ring is just a symbol, but good for you. So it sounds like you're a pretty financially savvy guy. What do you need us for?
I've been considering getting a credit card in order to take advantage of cash rewards and to build my credit responsibly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So after being denied for two credit cards, I decided to check my credit report to see if there was something wrong. And I discovered that because I share my first and last name with my father, his name appeared on my credit report.
Mm.
And I've recently written one of the credit bureaus to try and clear his name from my record.
Okay.
So I was calling to make sure that this is the best method for removing incorrect information from my report. And I'm very used to communicating via email and was wondering if writing is still the preferred method.
Okay. The mix-up with the name, it's not uncommon, so we can deal with it. And what you've done is terrific. I spend a little more time on it just to clear it up. And my advice is two things. One, because I have a visceral dislike. I think as most people have a visceral dislike of the credit reporting bureaus. And I also think that they've been unresponsive to the consumer. However, having said that, they have been responding more recently.
Mm-hmm.
And they have truly improved their online process.
And I can tell you just from my personal experience, I did this within the last couple of months. And I did it online and I had to dispute things with all three agencies. And the response time was incredibly quick. I was very surprised.
You know, you get an email back from them immediately.
Yes.
And the 30-day clock starts. Because there's a name thing here and it's not completely uncommon, what I would also do is call them and ask for customer service. They you go to the website, they all have the numbers, ask for customer service and say, here's the situation I'm dealing with. What do you recommend? And since they've had to deal with this before, I think actually talking to a human being might even speed the process a little more.
Okay.
Thanks so much for the call. And
thank you.
When are you getting married?
That is still up in the air.
Uh-huh.
Both in graduate school.
Well, good for you and congratulations on your engagement.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, our website is marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link there or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right, let's reach into the email bag, and C. Pie writes in from Las Cruces, New Mexico. And her 20-year-old younger brother is at a great point in his life where he has most of his college education paid off. He's got a well-to-do weekend job, so C. Pie has been telling him he should invest some of his earnings. But she doesn't know what specifically he should invest in. Chris, of course, we do not make specific recommendations on where you should put your money, right?
Right. First of all, he's got a good older sister.
Yeah.
but my first thought is, one, how about setting up a Roth IRA?
Okay.
And as you know, Tess, with the Roth IRA, it's after-tax dollars you put into it, but in what, 20-year-old brother, so say in 40 years, when he withdraws the money, all the gain is for your taxes? That's one good strategy. The other strategy is, you know, young people, they move a lot. They search for their careers. Would be to do a strategy where part of the money goes into, Standard Poor's 500 equity index fund. And then the rest goes into cash. And it's sort of what they call a barbell strategy. So, you know, one side is invested very long term. But if you need it in 5, 6, 10 years, you can withdraw it without penalty because it's not a retirement account. It's just a regular old Standard Poor's 500 equity index fund. And then the other part of the barbell is cash. So if you have to move to another city for a job opportunity, you have the money to do it. If you go work for a company and you can't stand it, you can quit because you have these savings. So those are at least two thoughts of how to think about where to put this extra money that he has.
Okay. Well, C. Pie, there's some advice for you to pass along to your younger brother. And hey, why don't you tell him to tune into the show and he can learn even more about what to do with his money. Right, Chris?
That's right. He can download it.
All right. Those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. And as always, you can call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks, as always, for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Beth.
We watched this week as the list of layoffs in our own industry grew. 150 of our colleagues at the Los Angeles Times got pink slips, or a version thereof. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution cut nearly 200 jobs. There is not a whole lot of good news coming out of corporate America these days, but a new survey out this week does show one bright spot. Danielle Carson reports.
These may be tough economic times, but the Society for Human Resource Management found most companies aren't hitting the panic button and scaling back benefits programs. In fact, many are helping their employees manage one of today's biggest economic burdens, filling up the gas tank.
Many organizations are becoming more sensitive to how this is impacting employees. There are some organizations that have started to implement telecommuting or flexible schedule options, such as 4-day work weeks, for example, specifically as a result of the rising gas prices.
Steve Williams is the association's research director. Sure, some benefits like stock options or paid paternity leave have taken a hit this year. But Williams says a growing number of businesses realize that making wholesale cutbacks to benefits, especially during an economic downturn, can carry a high price, losing talented workers. So companies are rolling out what are called soft benefits, like company-provided cell phones or fitness center memberships. Kevin Andrews is CEO of the consulting firm SmartBen.
What they consider to be a benefit may not necessarily cost you as much as you think. They're not lowering your deductible for your health plan, but they may be impacting more people and help them have a lifestyle change.
The survey found companies are adding all kinds of new perks. About 29% offered free financial advice to employees in 2000. That number jumped to nearly 40% this year. Andrew says more companies are also taking a new tack, pitching existing benefits.
In a time like today, they can't give the big raises or add nice fluffy new benefits. They need to make sure employees understand and appreciate what they already have.
And association researcher Steve Williams says more companies are taking a proactive approach to managing spiraling healthcare costs.
Some of them are ramping up wellness programs because they know that in the long run, if you have a good wellness program in place, it will help to alleviate costs and the impact that it has on the overall cost of healthcare.
In 2003, about 60% of businesses offered wellness programs. This year, it's more than 70%, including Marriott Corporation. The Fortune 500 company used to follow the old HR handbook. Jill Berger oversees the company's health benefits programs.
We used to charge a copay for preventive care. In fact, years ago, we didn't even cover preventive care. Now we see the importance of not only covering it, but making it free, because that will keep them out of the hospital.
The bottom line? Companies save money in the long run by integrating wellness programs into their benefits plans. Just ask Doug Lehman, Executive VP of Gilsbar, which manages health care plans for 250 employers. He says it took several years to get their own numbers headed in the right direction.
Our health plan costs are 6% lower than they were 5 years ago, and our prescription drug costs, which everybody complains about, is 45% lower than they were 5 years ago, and 85% say their benefit package is better today than it was 5 years ago. Yet we're paying less, and we have happier, more productive people.
As the definition of family changes, businesses are being guided by a new playbook to keep their employees happy and productive. The benefits survey found that more than a third now offer health care coverage to same-sex partners, and more than 60% pay for long-distance calls when a worker is on the road and wants to phone home. In Washington, I'm Danielle Carson for Marketplace Money.
And in the interest of full disclosure, the Society for Human Resource Management is an underwriter of this program. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, we look at factors to consider when you're downsizing your gas tank.
You know, when somebody pulls in a truck, they're trying to get out of the truck. You know, they're just spending so much money.
Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Stephen Hoffman, Caitlin Carroll, Jeff Peters, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. American Public Media.